Hare Krishna. So, delighted to be here amongst all of you. So, as Dr. Priyaprabhu said in the introduction that, you know, I was there in the first one-time program in the college. So, actually speaking, like sometimes a politician comes to a place to inaugurate a place, and the politician goes off everywhere else. And then it is the local team that actually builds the whole project. So I was fortunate to be a part of history in the making at that time. And all of you have very competently carried on that legacy. It's wonderful to see such a, see DTs, to see a big temple hall and see all of your enthusiastic smiling faces. And of course, Kurani Mai Prabhu and I go a long time back, and so your whole team has been taking care of and savoring and sharing, savoring ourselves and sharing the spiritual wisdom of bhakti with others. So happy to be here with all of you. And Kurani Mai Prabhu requested that I speak on the topic of the mind. So, I'll speak on learning to live with the mind. Normally, we think about controlling the mind, conquering the mind, but today I'll focus on learning to live with the mind. So, I'll take four verses from the Bhagavad Gita. It's a discussion between Krishna and Arjuna from 6.33 to 6.36. Among all the chapters in the Bhagavad Gita, it is the sixth chapter that talks extensively about the mind. And Srila Prabhupada explains in his purports in the sixth chapter that the essence of the process of yoga is not sitting in any particular posture, but it is focusing the mind. And after Krishna describes to Arjuna how by the process of yoga, prashanta manasam hyenam yoginam sukham uttamam upaiti shanta rajasam brahma bhutam kalmasham. So he says in 6.27 that prashanta manasam hyenam, by the steady practice of yoga, the mind will become peaceful. Prashanta manasam hyenam yoginam sukham uttamam. The yogi will experience the supreme happiness. So actually, when the mind becomes peaceful, the yogi becomes joyful. When the mind becomes peaceful, we are all aspiring yogis, bhakti yogis, but we are yogis. So when the mind becomes peaceful, we become joyful. And till the mind has not become peaceful, bhakti or any process of yoga is a struggle. So Krishna says over here that when the mind becomes prashanta, then what will happen? Yogina sukham uttamam. The yogi will experience uttama sukha, transcendental happiness. Upaiti shanta rajasam. Rajas, the rajoguna, which makes us agitated, that will become peaceful. Brahma bhutam akalmasham. One will understand one's spiritual nature free from all contaminations. And then after that, in 6.28, 29, 30, Krishna talks about progressively higher levels of spiritual realization. 6.28 talks about Brahman realization. Sukhena Brahma Samsparsham Atyantam Sukham Ashnute. There also he talks about the process of steady practice. Union Evam Sadatmanam Yogi Vigata Kalmashaha. Union Evam Sadatmanam. In fact, we consider the Atma, when Atma is used in the form of nominative, there are different forms of words in grammar. So Atmanam. So Atman actually contains the word mana also in it. So the idea is that the mana is a part of our whole being. So Krishna, in 28th verse, he talks about the Brahman realization. 29th text, he talks about Paramatma realization. Sarvabhutasthamatmanam sarvabhutani chatmani ikshate yoga yuktatma sarvatra samadarshanaha. One who sees the universe in the Supreme and the Supreme in the universe. One who sees this way, such a person is spiritually realized. This is the Paramatma realization. And 30th text, talks about Bhagavan realization. Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan are three aspects of the Absolute Truth. Yomam pashyati sarvatra sarvam cha mai pashyati tasyaham na pranashyami sa cha me na pranashyati. Those who see me everywhere and see everything in me, they are never lost. Now after this, so now we may say, okay, we look at, we understand Brahman, we understand Paramatma, we understand Bhagavan. But what after that? Now what, how do we look at the world? It is not that we don't care for the world. We learn to see actually that same Paramatma present in all living. Sarvabhut sthitam yoma bhajatyekatvam asthitam sarvatha vartamanopi sayogi mai vartate. One who sees that same Supreme whom I am real, let's switch this off. That same Supreme whom we are realizing in the heart, that same Supreme is also present in all living beings. So we see the equality of all living beings. Not that they are all one, absolutely, but that they are all beloved for the Supreme One. They are all a part of our same universal family. And thus, the yogic vision leads not so much, not to detachment, but to compassion. Not so much to renunciation, but to compassion. See, sometimes people think of renunciation as not caring for things. But renunciation actually means caring for something higher, by which one doesn't get obsessed so much with caring for lower things. So just like a child, when the children grow up, in childhood they may just be caught up in playing. But as they grow up, then they have more constructive things to do in their life. So it's not that they don't care for playing in the sense that they hate playing. There is a phase in life when people have to play. But now I have outgrown the phase. Of course, nowadays with video games, people never outgrow the phase. Sometimes people, even elderly people also, just keep getting caught in playing. Now there's a new video game called Pokemon Go which has come, which is becoming a craze. You know, people are meeting with road accidents, car accidents. They're just lost in playing the game. And they don't know where they are going, what they are doing. So some people may not outgrow, but normally when we have something more constructive to do, then the less constructive things, we automatically become indifferent to them. So the advanced yogi, it's not that they don't care for the things of this world. Actually, their renunciation brings compassion. Atma upamyena sarvatra samam pashyati arjuna sukham va yadiva dukham sayogi paramomataha. So in 32nd text, Krishna tells Arjuna that this yogi is, what do they say? Atma upamyena sarvatra. They say that actually the Atma in all living beings is the same. Sarvatra samam pashyati arjuna. See, all living beings are equal in that sense. Sukham va yadi va dukham. In the happiness and in distress. Sa yogi paramomataha. Such a yogi is paramomataha. So yogi is having the highest vision. Nowadays there is a great threat of terrorism in the world. And some people, they're just not able to digest the idea of, you know, brutal terrorism, and they try to simplistically say, okay, what is the cause of terrorism? Islam is the cause of terrorism. Now, yes, Islamic ideology can spawn terrorism, but there is no simplistic one-to-one correlation. Ultimately, people are not, if we are actually seeing spiritually, people are not Muslims, people are not Hindus, people are not Christians, people are souls. And the souls can get affected by the modes, and when they get affected by the modes, especially by the lower mode of passion and ignorance, then they can act in horrible ways. So if Islam itself were the cause of terrorism, then Islam has been existing for 1500 years. So why Taliban and ISIS come now? So yes, religion can be a cause, but economics is a cause, politics is a cause, social unrest is a cause. There are so many other causes that contribute to it. So the point which I am making is, some people in a material vision, they demonize the other. Okay. We Hindus are good, those Muslims are bad. Or it can be in any way. It can be in Hitler's Germany, the idea we Nazi Germans are good, those Jews are bad. So simplistically, dividing people according to some kind of racial, religious, geographical boundaries, that is a superficial vision. Because
ultimately everyone is a soul. And people, when they become influenced by the lower modes, they will act in demoniac ways.
Actually, this first suicide bombing was done not by Islamic terrorists, it was done by LTT, which was
a secular organization.
The LTT did not believe in any religion or anything like that.
So, it is when people are in Rajoguna, Tamoguna, they will act in demoniac ways. And while going into Rajoguna and Tamoguna, they may have different reasons for that.
Some may use religious ideology as a reason, some may use racist ideology as a reason, some may use nationalist ideology as a reason.
So different people can use different rationalizations, but we, if we are seeing through philosophy, we should see that all souls are essentially similar. All souls are essentially similar. And when the soul, sukham va yadiva dukham sayogi parmomataha, that in happiness and in distress, all living beings are similar. So what this means is, the yogis see that when people are disconnected from God, when people are not in spiritual consciousness, they will suffer. When people get connected with God, when they are in spiritual consciousness, then they will be happy. And in this way, there is compassion. What is the compassion for? To connect everyone with spirituality. To help raise everyone's consciousness. So this is the vision of compassion of the topmost yogi. Krishna says, such yogis are the topmost yogis. So yogi paramomataha. It is the Parama, topmost yogi. Now at this point, Krishna stops and Arjuna asks a question. So all this I spoke till now was the background of the topic. So Arjuna says in the 33rd text now, Yoyam yogasvaya prokta samyena madhusudana etasyaham na pashyami chanchalatva stitim sthiram. So he says that, oh Arjuna, oh Krishna, this process that you have spoken, samyena means samata, equanimity. Says, you say that I should see everyone equally. It's not practical. Etasyaham na pashyami. I'll not be able to see like this. Chanchalatvat sthitim sthiram. The mind is very restless. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is a prominent commentator on the Bhagavad Gita, on the Bhagavatam also. But in his Bhagavad Gita commentary, he says that Arjuna is thinking, Krishna, if you're saying that I should see all living beings equally, does that mean I should see Yudhishthir, who is Dharmaraj, who is the personification of dharma, and Duryodhana, who is the personification of adharma? Am I meant to see both of them equally? I am going to fight against Duryodhana and I am going to fight for Yudhishthira. How can I see both of them equally? So he said, this doesn't seem practical to me. And then the theme of chanchala, which he is saying in this verse, he elaborates in the next text. In 34th text he says, chanchalam himanah krishna pramathi balavadrudham tasyaham nigraham manye vayoriva sudushkaram. So he says, this mind is chanchala, restless. Krishna, pramathi is, now children are also restless. But children are simply mischievous. You know, children are sitting here, they go there. But suppose, if it's not just a child, sometimes in some mental asylums, there are people who are physically very well built, but their mind is restless. Actually, sometimes when they go crazy, and then 4, 5, 6 people are required to restrain them, because they are not small. So if somebody is restless, that is a problem. But pramathi, it's not just innocent restlessness, it's madness. Then it becomes very difficult. And then on top of that, he says balavat. So it's like it's not just a restless person, it's a mad person, it's like an intoxicated person, a mad person who is also very powerful. Balavat. Drudham. It's one thing, somebody may be strong, but those people see reason. We tell them, okay, this is not right. And they understand and they accept it. But drudha means obstinate. So actually the same quality can work both ways. You know, holding on tightly to something can be determination. But holding on tightly to something undesirable, that is obstinacy. So what we are holding on to determines whether something is determination or something is obstinacy. See, the name Dhritarashtra, it was not necessarily a negative name. Dhritarashtra, often the meaning is given as Dhrita means to hold on to. Rashtra is kingdom. So one who is very attached to the kingdom and who held on to the kingdom. And that was Dhritarashtra's life story. He was very, very irrationally, adharmically attached to his kingdom. But That was not the original intent of that name. Dhritarashtra means one who sustains the kingdom, one who holds on to the kingdom and maintains the kingdom. And that's what a king is supposed to do. So, even a king has to protect the national bond, the state boundaries, whatever they are. And for that, the king has to maintain, hold on to the kingdom. But that has to be done in the pursuit of dharma. But if one does that with selfishness, with irrationality, with irreligiosity, then that becomes negative. So, the point is, obstinacy and determination are in one sense two sides of the same coin. Sometimes some devotees say that, no, I have no determination. I have no determination at all. You know, if I had to wake up in the morning, I just can't wake up. I just can't do it. So actually, rather than saying we have no determination, we should see that when I say I am not able to do something, when I am not able to wake up in the morning, that means I have determination to keep sleeping in the morning. So it's not that we lack determination, it's just that we have determination for something which is not the best. So say, suppose if we are in a place, some people are very lazy. Now actually, nobody likes lazy people. People just chastise, you are a lazy person, do this, why are you not doing this? People chastise, people mock, people deride. And in spite of that, that person continues on being lazy. So, they have a determination for laziness. So actually Krishna talks about this in the 18th chapter, 35th verse. He says this is determination in the mode of ignorance. Yaya swapnam bhayam shokam vishadam matame vacha navimunchati durmedha dhruti sapartha tamasi. Tamasi. In ignorance, the determination is where people keep doing all this, yaya swapnam bhayam shokam. Swapnam is daydreaming, not just dreaming, daydreaming. They are in this bhayam, always being fearful. This may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong. Now people are just paranoid. Bhayam shokam, always being negative. Whatever idea we give them, they find problems with the idea. This will not work, this will not work, this will not work. Well, what works then? Actually, to always be negative is not at all pleasant. But although it is not pleasant, they hold on to that unpleasant disposition. And that requires determination. So, no one can say that I don't have determination. We all have determination. It's just that our determination is misdirected. And bhakti is actually the process to redirect that misdirected determination. I'll come to that later. But the point I'm making is drudham. Obstinacy means determination which is misdirected. So, these four characteristics of the mind, Arjuna tells, that it is restless, it is intoxicated, it is strong, and it is obstinate. And these four make the mind very, very difficult to manage. And he gives an example. Vayoriva sudushkaram. Vayoriva. This is very, very difficult to control. It's like the wind blazes. It's a stormy wind. You cannot stop it. Just sweeps everything away in its path. Sometimes we have experiences of, say, cyclones or tornadoes. When they come, everything is swept away. So from big towers, big trees, they are just swept away. So it's like the mind is like that. It just sweeps everything away. How can it be controlled? Now, Krishna's response is very interesting. He, in 6.35 and 36, he responds actually in two verses, after which Arjuna asks another question. So in 35 he says that asamshayam mahabaho manodurnigraham chanam abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagena chinruyate. Asamshayam mahabaho, undoubtedly, O Krishna, manodurnigraham chalam, the mind is very difficult to control. It is restless, chala. Krishna is using the similar word, chanchala and chala. Chala means restless. Yes, it is difficult to control, but abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagena chigruhyate. Abhyasa, by practice, and by detachment. Vairagya, by these two things, we will be able to control the mind. So now, interestingly, here, Krishna gives a generic answer. Prior to this, Arjuna has heard from Krishna the process of Ashtanga Yoga, which is basically going to jungle, suchau deshe pratishthapya sthiram asanam atmana नात्युच्युतं नाति नीचं चैलाजिन्दुषोत्तरं तत्रैकाग्रमनं कृत्वा चित्तेन्द्रियक्रिया उपविश्यासने युञ्जात् योगमात्मविशुद्धये. 6.11 and 12 he says that go in the jungle, sit on a seat that is neither too elevated nor too much on the ground, lay down kusha grass, use deer skin, and then sit down and focus on the mind and practice yoga. So that is the process which Krishna has taught from 6.11 onwards, 6.10, 11 onwards, till 6.30, till this point before Arjuna asks 6.32, where Arjuna asks the question. So that Krishna has described that particular process, and then Arjuna has expressed his objection. And Krishna responds by saying, practice. Abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagyena cha vidyate. By practice and by detachment, you will be able to succeed. So Krishna does not endorse the process of Ashtanga Yoga, nor does he reject the process of Ashtanga Yoga. He simply states that you have to practice. And he reiterates that theme in the next verse, which I'll come to a little later. But right now, you know, when we study Srila Prabhupada's purports, sometimes we may find that there is one thing which is said in the Sanskrit verse, and if you know a little bit Sanskrit, and we find Prabhupada is saying something different in the translation. So we wonder, why is Prabhupada doing like this? Some people say, what is this? You know, and then Prabhupada, the Sanskrit is saying something, the translation something is saying something else. And on top of that, Prabhupada says this Bhagavad Gita is as it is. Well, if the translation itself is different from the Sanskrit, and some verses says that Sanskrit is Karma Yoga, Prabhupada says Bhakti Yoga. So then how can you say it is as it is? Actually, when Prabhupada says as it is, what does he mean? He means as it is in terms of essential conclusion. It is not in terms of technical precision. So technical precision means, if we go into the Bhagavad Gita, it's so technical. Now, okay, this process of yoga, what are the advantages of that? What are the disadvantages of that? What are the pros and cons? And how this level is higher than this level? How this level is at this level? So, the Bhagavad Gita is in one sense a very technical book. And and that technical precision of the Gita's flow and analysis, that has been done by previous acharyas. And Prabhupada is aware of that. Prabhupada knows what is happening over there. So, if, for example, if you read in the 2.72, second chapter, 72 verses, the last verse of the purport, last purport of the last verse. So, there Prabhupada says, in this chapter, Karma Yoga has been described and a hint of Bhakti Yoga has been given. However, if you read Srila Prabhupada's purport, he has not given a hint, he has given a full picture. So now, what is Prabhupada doing? Prabhupada himself tells what is his strategy. He says, people in Kali Yuga are upadritaha, they are very disturbed. It is said that the condition of Kali Yuga is aneka shastram bahuveditavyam alpascha kalaha bahavascha vignaha. So, aneka shastram, there are so many scriptures. And then bahuveditavyam, you know, every sentence of the scripture can have different meanings. There are so many commentaries written. Alpascha kalaha, we have so little time. Bahavascha vignaha, and we have so many obstacles. Now we sit down to read, and then our mind is like a bird sitting on a perch. One clap and it flies away. So we sit down to read, and but the mind just wanders all over the universe. And if it doesn't wander anywhere else in the universe, then it wanders to one place. That is Nidra Loka. It just goes to sleep. So, Bahavascha Vigna. There are so many obstacles. Therefore, Tatsara Bhutam Tadupasitavyam. Therefore, just focus on the essence. Tatsara Bhutam. Just focus on the essence. So, what Srila Prabhupada does is, he says that people in this age are not likely to be patient enough to go through the technical precision of the Gita. So he says, his strategy is that if people open any page of my book, on any page anywhere, they should get my essential message. They should get not my essential message, in the sense that the essential message of the Bhagavad Gita. So the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna gives at the end, Prabhupada gives throughout. So Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is as it is, in the sense that the essential conclusion is preserved as it is. So, what is the essential conclusion? sarvadharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam raja. So sarvadharman parityajya, you know, so what happens in the sixth chapter, Krishna is telling, go out in the jungle. Chuchau deshe patishtha pisiram asam natmana. And Prabhupada says in his purport, this is not practical, you should chant Hare Krishna. Somebody will say, what is this? You are supposed to comment, but you are cancelling the words. You are contradicting the words. But actually, Prabhupada is not contradicting, Krishna himself contradicts at the end. So when Krishna is saying, actually it's not a contradiction, it's a higher revelation. What is Krishna saying? Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam raja. Give up all varieties of religions and surrender unto me. So you know, there are some Hindu, there is one Hindu scholar who just couldn't digest the idea of how can God tell you to give up dharma. So he changed the Bhagavad Gita. And he made this 18.66 as Sarva adharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam raja. Give up all adharma and surrender unto me. Yeah, that is his concern is valid, but the point is, how can God tell someone to give up adharma? That's a valid concern. But we have to see that Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, and Arjuna is already a dharmic person. So for him, adharma is not an option only. So for him, for Arjuna, the question was, I have kula dharma and I have kshatriya dharma. Kula dharma means my family duty. According to my family duty, I should protect my family members. I should not attack or kill my family members. So kula dharma, if it is, he has to follow kula dharma, then he should not fight against the Kauravas, especially because his grandfather Bhishma is over there. But according to kshatriya dharma, he should fight against aggressors. A kshatriya is meant to counter aggressors. So the Kauravas have abused their wife, the Kauravas have stolen their kingdom, the Kauravas have tried to poison them, the Kauravas have tried to burn them alive. So such aggressors should be punished. So Arjuna's conflict at the start of the Bhagavad Gita is, which dharma is higher? Kula dharma or kshatriya dharma? So for Arjuna, adharma was not an option only. So his option, there are two dharmas, which dharma should I be following? And Krishna answers by telling, follow, give up all dharmas and follow that dharma which enables you to do mam ekam sharanam braja. Follow that dharma which enables you to do. So sarva dharman parityajya doesn't mean that Krishna is saying you become adharmic. Srila Prabhupada says in one lecture, the hippies were also following sarva dharman parityajya. You know, the hippies in America, they had given up their family, they had given up their education, they had given up their careers, they had given up their jobs. They are doing sarva dharman parityajya. But it needed Prabhupada to teach them how to do mam ekam sharanam braja. How to surrender to Krishna. So the point is that Krishna is telling Arjuna, yes, there can be multiple levels of dharma, but don't get caught in that. Focus on that process of dharma which will enable you to do mam ekam sharanam braja. And in while doing that, if you give up some other dharma, and even if some sin happens because of that, aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami mam shuchaha, I will free you from all sinful reactions. So that means Krishna talks about various practice, dharmic practices. So there can be karma kanda, there can be karma yoga, there can be jnana yoga, ashtang yoga. And Krishna says, give all of them up and practice bhakti. So what Krishna is doing at the end is what Prabhupada does throughout the Gita. So Prabhupada is fulfilling Krishna's purpose by giving the essential conclusion throughout. So the context of this is, why we are discussing here it, that here Prabhupada says that actually Arjuna objects to the process of Ashtanga Yoga. He says this is not practical. And then Krishna recommends Bhakti Yoga. So Krishna recommends Bhakti Yoga, but not here. So here Krishna says, use practice. And by practice, you will be able to detach yourself. So sixth chapter is called as Dhyana Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga. The eighth chapter, in the seventh chapter, Krishna introduces Bhakti Yoga. And in the eighth chapter, Krishna compares Ashtanga Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. And after comparing Ashtanga Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, in 8.14, that's the only verse in which, in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says something is easy. The process of yoga and the process of spiritual progress is easy. He says, Abhyasena to count, no sorry, Abhyasa Yoga, no. Abhyasa Yoga Yukti na Chetasana Anyaga Minna. Tasyaham Sulabha Partha Nitya Yuktasya Yoginaha Tasyaham Sulabha Partha. For that person, I am easily attained. नित्ययुक्तस्य योगिनः अनन्यचेतः सततं यो मां स्मरति नित्यशः. But one who without deviation remembers me. For such a person, perfection is easily attained. I am easily attained. So what is Krishna telling? This is always remembering Krishna is the process of Bhakti Yoga. So Krishna is recommending that, Arjuna, you said in the 6th chapter that, oh, this process of yoga is very difficult. So I agree, it's difficult, but we have to practice it. And if we practice it, then you will attain perfection. And the best way to practice it is, not through Ashtanga Yoga, but through Bhakti Yoga. By the practice of Bhakti Yoga, you will be able to attain perfection. So, now, what are these two things he says? Abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagyena cha gruhyate. By practice and by detachment, you will be able to attain perfection. So, what is this practice and detachment? This I will elaborate in tomorrow's class. But, till what time can we go on? 8:30, okay. So, I will give one example which I will elaborate tomorrow. And we will talk specifically about the mind control more there, but because I would like to have some question answers also. So, this Abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagyena cha gruhyate. What is he referring to? By practice and by detachment. So, sometimes when we start understanding that the mind creates so many problems for me, it distracts me, it degrades me, we may go to the mode of becoming averse to the mind. We start hating or loathing the mind. But both attachment and aversion are problematic. That's why I said the topic title is learning to live with the mind. So I'll give an example. Suppose, you know, a person is a ranch owner. You know, the person has a big farm. And now it's a rural setting, so they don't have any vehicle. So they have a horse. The owner has a horse. And the horse is wild. Now if this owner is careless and the owner gets on the horse, two things may happen. One is the horse may just rear and throw away the owner. The owner may get injured. If the owner falls off on the path of the horse may stampede and break bones and even kill the owner. The other possibility is that the horse may just rear, run off. And the owner may want to go in one place, but the wild horse may take him somewhere else. So like that, the horse can be very dangerous. But at the same time, if the owner starts saying, I hate this horse. I just hate this horse. I won't go near the horse also. But if there's a huge ranch and the ranch has to be overseen, supervised, managed, the owner needs the horse for going around. So, what is required is not attachment. Attachment means, oh, I just sit with the horse and I'm careless. Whatever the horse wants to do, I let the horse do it. Aversion means I won't touch the horse also. But what is needed is discretion, is caution. Yes, I need the horse, but I have to be careful while managing the horse. So like that, you know, the soul is spiritual, the body is material. And the mind is the essential interface between the soul and the body. The mind is the essential interface. Just as the ranch owner needs the horse to go around in the ranch, so for functioning in this world, the soul needs the interfacing mechanism of the mind. Shrotram chakshu sparshanam cha rasanam ghranam eva cha adhishthaya manaschayam vishayan upasevate. Krishna analyzes this further in 15.8 and 9 in the Bhagavad Gita, and he says all the senses are centered around the mind, and the soul is connected with the mind, and the soul functions in this world through the mind. So if we cannot get rid of the mind, we cannot become averse to the mind, we have to cautiously deal with the mind. So if we are just indiscreet, that means what happens? We are not watchful. Then wherever we are sitting and supposed to do one thing, but the mind goes here and there and we just wander all over the universe with the mind. That is distractedness. Or sometimes the mind makes us do, not just passively we wander here and there, the mind sometimes makes us do foolish things. The mind makes us do dangerous things. You know, sometimes people just overeat. And then after overeating, they say, why did I do that? And you know, nowadays people are very, very figure conscious. They want to look thin and they want to look slim and attractive. So what happens? People overeat and they get so panicky that there are some special medicines which they take to try to vomit out what they have eaten. And then they hope that, you know, my weight will not increase. I've eaten, but the weight will not increase. it's a very intrusive and harmful way of
trying to deal with the fear of weight loss or weight gain rather.
But the point is, people just, why did I eat that? So what is happening over there is that they are indiscreet and the mind makes them do things which are harmful for them. So that sort of indiscretion in dealing with the mind is carelessness, apathy is not desirable. But if you start hating the mind, that will also not work, because we have to live with the mind. The mind is inside us and we have to learn to manage it. So how to manage it? That is abhyasa konteya vairagya. Abhyasa means, you know, there is if in India people don't use horses so much, or kshatriyas used to use in the past, but there is something called breaking a horse. You know, when a new horse comes, the horse has never been ridden by anyone. Then a trained person is required to break the horse. Break the horse doesn't mean to break its bones. Break the horse means to break its unruliness. That means an expert person gets onto the horse. So they approach, if the horse is wild, even approaching the horse has to be done very cautiously. So they slowly, steadily they approach the horse, they'll climb on the horse, and very carefully and expertly the collier is a person who is a person who takes care of horses, collier or some other horse expert, they actually break the horse. Break the horse means they tame, discipline the horse. And once the horse is disciplined, then even a lay person who may not be so expert at horse management, when they can come and ride the horse, and the horse will be trained and disciplined at that time. So what is required is, abhyasa means practice. So it's not that first time the person sits on the horse, even the horse expert, it's not that first time they sit on the horse is going to behave meekly or submissive. But then you have to keep trying. So like that, abhyasa, we have to practice. The mind doesn't focus, but practice. We'll discuss more about what this practice practically means in tomorrow's class. But practice. And vairagya, what does it mean? It can mean two things. One is that if the horse gets infatuated with something, don't just go off after that. Check the horse. But the other is, so that means we may be attached to something, we have to become detached from that. So, but that means if the mind starts saying, do this, it's not that we do it immediately. But another understanding of detachment is, we also have to become detached from the idea of instant success. That means we shouldn't think that, okay, yesterday I made a resolution and from today I'll be a pure devotee. It's not going to work like that. It's not. We have to accept the reality that when we start trying to walk on the spiritual path, sometimes we may slip, sometimes we may fall. So detached means, we should not be detached to our own conception of perfection. Perfection will come gradually. And we need to patiently mourn. Even if I fall, I'll rise. It's not that because I have fallen down, so I have to just give up. No, even if I've fallen, I rise and I keep going onwards. So that way, it's like a person is trying to ride a horse. If they say that, this horse knocked me down, I will never go near all. That's not going to work. So detachment means, we have to be detached from attachment, and we have to be detached from aversion also. So in a detached way, we keep doing what is the needful. And thus we move onwards. And Bhakti Yoga enables us to do both, because Bhakti Yoga enables us to go beyond this binary of attachment and detachment, because we develop a higher attachment to Krishna. And by that higher attachment, we learn to rein in and direct the mind. And that we will discuss more in tomorrow's class. I'll summarize. I started by talking about how the Bhagavad Gita 6th chapter talks about control of the mind. So I basically took an overview of 6.20, from 6.27 to 6.35, 35. So 6.27 basically is that when the mind becomes peaceful, we become joyful. And to pacify the mind is the purpose of yoga. And then after we become peaceful, after we become joyful, then spiritual realization starts awakening. So then we discuss 6.28 talks about Brahman realization, 6.29 talks about Paramatma realization, 6.30 talks about Bhagavan realization, and 6.31 talks about how we learn to see all living beings equally. So the perfection of yoga is not just renunciation, it is compassion. That is not that renunciation means we don't care for others, rather we care for people with a higher understanding. And then After that, we discussed about how the yogi, in 6.32, the yogis see all living beings equally. And in that connection, we discussed how we should not brand one group of people as good and another group of people as bad. In any group of people, there are people in goodness, passion and ignorance. And for whatever reason, if people go into passion or ignorance, then they are going to act terribly. And religion can be a cause, race can be a cause, nationality can be a cause, caste can be a cause, there can be many causes. So, we shouldn't brand this kind of people as bad and this kind of people as good. We need to see all living beings equally. And then we have to deal with them appropriately, whatever is required. But we shouldn't see them as bad. They are intrinsically bad. And then Arjuna expresses objection saying that this is very difficult. How can I see Yudhishthir and Dharmaraj, Yudhishthir and Adharmik Duryodhana, how can I see them equally? So, and then he further says, the mind is restless, intoxicated, strong and stubborn. So, obstinate. So, we discuss that nobody can say that I don't have determination. We have determination, but it is misdirected. So, when I say that I don't have determination for something, that means I have determination for the opposite thing. So what I need to do is purify myself so that the determination can come from the opposite to the right thing. And then Krishna is very sympathetic. He says, yes, it's difficult to control the mind, but it is possible by practice and detachment. And there we discuss elaborately about Prabhupada's strategy in giving his purports. Prabhupada focuses not on technical precision, but on essential conclusion. So, rather, the technical flow of the Gita is very intricate, and previous acharyas have commented on that, and those who are interested can study it. But most of the people in Kali Yuga, they have little time and they have huge distraction. So, and the mind is like a bird which just goes off with a small clap of distraction. So what Prabhupada does is, on every page he gives the essential message. So what Krishna gives in the conclusion, Prabhupada gives throughout. So Krishna says, Krishna has given talk, analyzes various parts, but at the end he says, Sarvadharman Parityaja Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. So he is saying, Arjuna, you have various considerations. You have considerations, is it Kul Dharma higher or Kshatriya Dharma higher? He says, no. The highest is that dharma which enables you to surrender to Mamekam. So practice Bhakti Yoga, and for that Bhakti Yoga, whatever you need to do, you do that. And if you have to neglect some other dharma, I'll take care of sinful reactions. So Krishna himself subordinates all the other parts and he says practice bhakti. And that's what Prabhupada gives in all his purports. And then Krishna here doesn't reject the path of Ashtanga Yoga. Krishna gives a non-specific recommendation to just practice and to be detached. And then I discuss in the flow of the Bhagavad Gita in the 8th chapter, whereas Arjuna has said this process is very difficult, Krishna says that process is easy. And then Tasyaham Sulabha Path. Sulabha is easily. So Krishna endorses Bhakti Yoga there in the 8th chapter categorically. And we discussed how to deal with the mind and what does Abhyasa and Vairagya mean. We discussed the metaphor of a horse. A ranch owner cannot live without the horse. Similarly, we, as long as we are material existence, we cannot live without the mind. The mind is the essential interfacing mechanism for the soul to act with gross matter. So the ranch owner needs to be cautious. Can't be attached, can't be averse, but has to be cautious. So like that, if we are, we also need to be neither attached nor averse to the mind. We have to be cautious. So just as the horse can just take away the ranch owner anywhere and stampede on the horse owner, like that the mind can just distract us or make us do self-destructive things if we are not cautious. And by being cautious, by being vigilant, Abhyasa means keep doing the right thing. Just as a person wants to break a horse, they repeatedly keep approaching the horse and trying to ascend the horse. So keep practicing and be detached. Detached from, don't get carried away by whatever the mind says. At the same time, don't be detached from one's own conception of perfection and think that, okay, today I started, tomorrow I'll be perfect. No, be patient. Accept that there will be a slow process, sometimes we may slip and fall, and keep persevering and eventually success will be ours. So any questions? Okay.
Guruji, like, yeah. In the process of Abhyas, we do meet with some failures. So, how to deal with such failures and keep the determination on in such cases?
Okay. So, while practicing,
we've made some failures. So how to keep our determination and move onwards despite those failures? We are defined not by how we fall, but how we rise. Falls are going to happen, but they don't define us. We are defined by how we rise and move. See, if you consider our consciousness, if our material desires might be there, maybe lust or greed or anger, whatever it is. See, if our consciousness is at this level, then within that, sometimes there are spikes. Spikes means like you have electricity waveform, sometimes the electricity only goes up, spike is there. So we may need a spike guard on your computer to protect the delicate devices from those spikes. So like that, there are spikes in our consciousness. And when the spikes come, it appears as if, resisting the temptation is impossible. Now, when the spikes come, there are two things we need to know. First of all, the spike is not going to last forever. Although at that time it appears, how long can I keep fighting this? It's going to go on and on and on. How long can I keep fighting this? Better let me succumb now. So we may think that, okay, eventually I cannot keep fighting on, so let me succumb. But it's not like that. Sometimes we use the idea of a war against temptation, a spiritual war or a war against temptation. So you may think, okay, that enemy is so powerful and I am so weak. Anyway, I'm not going to win. So why keep fighting? But let me be defeated now only. But actually, we should understand that the war against temptation is not like a conventional war of one enemy against another enemy. It's more like weightlifting. See, when I lift a weight, I know that I'm not going to be able to lift the weight for the rest of my life. But that doesn't mean I should immediately put it down. Isn't it? As long as I can hold on, that much my muscles are being exercised. So like that, when the spike comes, the illusion is to think that this is the kind of agitation I am going to face lifelong. And then we just give up immediately. But actually the spikes in the desires don't last for very long. If you can just endure it during that phase, the desire will go away. So that's the first thing. So this, if we can remember that the spikes are not going to last forever, we will tolerate when they come. And that's how our fall itself will become lesser. But secondly, even if we fall, even if we slip and fall, what we should know is that, what do we do after that? After that, see, what happens is, the mind plays a very dangerous double role. What is the double role? First it tells us, do it, do it, do it, do it, do it. And then after we do it, you are a fool, why did you do it? Why did you do it? Why did you do it? Why did it just beats us up? Now we may think, actually I am repenting, I am feeling guilty, it's good. Yes, repentance is good, but repentance should raise our consciousness towards Krishna. If we are simply beating ourselves up, why did I do that, why did I do that, why did I do it, then what is happening? In both cases, we are simply mind conscious. First the mind said, do it, and afterwards it said, why did you do it? In both cases, we are simply listening to the mind. And if we are mind conscious, then next time the spike comes, the mind will again catch us. So we have to move from being mind conscious to being Krishna conscious. So okay, I did something wrong, fine. And even the later, fine is not that it's good, but okay, it's over now. Now I have an opportunity to be Krishna conscious. So that spike has come, maybe again after a few days or after some time the spike is going to come. But what do I do in the intermediate period? If at that time also I am still mind conscious, beating myself up, then I will be totally vulnerable when the spike comes again. But if in the intermediate period I think, okay, this happened, but still I have an opportunity to practice bhakti. It is not that Krishna has left my heart and gone away. Krishna never does that. So, there is nothing that we can ever do which can make Krishna stop loving us. There is nothing that we can ever do which can make Krishna stop loving us. Krishna always loves us no matter what we do. So knowing that, we still have the opportunity to do chant Hare Krishna, we still have the opportunity to practice bhakti. We start diligently practicing bhakti. And if we diligently practice bhakti, then that is making us spiritually stronger. And next time when the spike comes, we will be able to, we will be better equipped to deal with it. Even if next time also we fall. But still, if we keep practicing bhakti, gradually the odds will shift. See, as long as we are listening to the mind, we are making the mind stronger and ourselves weaker.
And sometimes the mind speaks so forcefully that it appears as if it's impossible to resist. But most of the time, it's not that the mind is terribly agitating us. So, when the mind's agitation is not very bad, at that time you focus on Krishna. Then what is happening? The mind is so powerful right now, or say lust or anger or greed, whatever it is, so powerful right now, and we are weak right now. And if we keep hearing the mind, then we will never become stronger. The mind will keep becoming stronger. The selfish desires, whatever it is there in the mind, they will keep becoming stronger. But if we, okay, whatever happens during the spikes, in the remaining time, I will keep hearing Krishna. I will diligently practice bhakti. I will engage in constructive activities. And what is happening? We are becoming stronger, 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 stronger. And the less we hear the mind also starts becoming weaker. And then eventually the odds will shift. And we will be able to deal with it. So when falls happen, we never lose till we lose hope. We never lose till we lose hope in the battle against the mind. And that's why the mind, what it does is, first it makes us lose and then it makes us lose hope. You are good for nothing. You are a fallen person and you are going to stay fallen, so better fall down more now.
So rather than succumbing to the mind like that,
okay, whatever happens during those spikes, what do I do during the remaining times? That is more important. And if you keep practicing bhakti diligently, we will ourselves become strong enough to resist the spikes. Does it answer your question? So I said that the mind is the essential link between the intelligence, between the soul and the body. But what about the intelligence and the ego? Yes, they all are. See, the word mind is sometimes used to refer to one component within the subtle body. In the subtle body, there is the intelligence, ego and the mind. But sometimes the mind is used as a shorthand for referring to the whole subtle body itself. So whatever it is, the mind, even if we consider the mind as referring to one specific component within the subtle body or to the whole subtle body itself, it is either a part or the whole of the mechanism which connects with the soul with the body. So in one sense, see, earth, water, fire, air, they are gross elements, and the difference is also gross. The earth is solid, the water is liquid, but that sort of rigid differentiation cannot be done between the mind, intelligence and ego. They are all subtle. So the primary difference in between the mind, intelligence and ego, if they are all subtle, is the difference in terms of functionality. The mind is more impulsive in its functioning. The intelligence is supposed to be more discrete, more rational, more analytical in its functioning. And the ego is basically the mode of identification. Actually, this, the whole mind, intelligence, ego, how they function, that I'll be talking in tomorrow's class. So I won't go into it right now. But essentially, yes, the mind is a part of the subtle body, which is a part of the interfacing mechanism. But either way, we do need the mind for interacting with the body. And that's why we cannot neglect the mind. We cannot entirely reject the mind, or we cannot hate the mind. We have to dovetail or use the mind. Okay. How can one practice devotional service directly, without going through all the other process of yoga? That is by the process of bhakti. Sorry, that is by the process of association of devotees. Normally, a person will not have the evolved consciousness necessary to appreciate Krishna and bhakti on one's own. See, on one's own, one may recognize, oh, this world is temporary. Say, some loved one dies, some terrible accident happens. One may start thinking, what is there beyond this world? And one may start inquiring. But the attraction to Krishna that is required for the practice of bhakti, that comes by the association of devotees. So if we can somehow associate with devotees, and from those devotees get the attraction for Krishna, then we also start practicing bhakti. Now we have to understand, sometimes we say that bhakti is the highest process. Therefore I am the highest transcendental. Therefore the bhakta is the highest transcendental. Therefore I am the highest transcendental. It's not like that. See, it's like, the various processes of yoga are like a ladder or like a staircase, and bhakti yoga is like the elevator. So it is very much possible that there may be ashtanga yogis, there may be jnana yogis, there may be karma yogis who may, if there is a 100 story building, they may be on the 95th story, and we may be bhakti yogis who are just on the second or third story right now. actually, in terms of practical living, in terms of detachment, in terms of sattvaguna, it is possible that other yogis may also be presently more advanced than bhakti yogis. But because they don't have attraction to Krishna, because they are not associated with devotees, so they have not entered into the elevator. That's why their progress, they may be more progress than us right now, but their progress will be slower, more laborious. It's like climbing stairs one by one step. Whereas we, if we get the association of devotees, it's like entering into the elevator. Once you have entered into the elevator, if you stay in the association of devotees, then that association will keep increasing our attraction to Krishna and will keep moving onward, onward, upwards towards Krishna. So the way we can get the opportunity to practice devotional service directly without going through all the other processes is by the association of devotees. And how can knowledge of karma yoga, jnana yoga, ashtanga yoga help us in practicing bhakti? It's not necessary that we have to know all these processes for practicing bhakti. But it is that if we know these processes, or at least in terms of analytical position of how these processes are, then we can better appreciate the glory of bhakti. And by appreciating the glory of bhakti, we will practice it with greater conviction. So knowledge itself does not foster devotion, but knowledge can foster the conviction that enables us to practice the process that fosters devotion.
What this means is that
knowledge alone, just by knowing philosophy, even by knowing about Krishna, just knowledge itself does not bring attraction towards Krishna. But there is a process for cultivating attraction towards Krishna. If I chant the holy names, if I worship the deities, if I study Shastra in a devotional mood, if I go to holy places, all these activities, because they are exposing me to Krishna more and more, they will increase my devotion gradually. They will increase my attraction towards Krishna. But if we have philosophical knowledge, then we will practice these processes with greater conviction. Now, many people chant Hare Krishna as a ritual. Many traditional people chant Hare Krishna or Ram Nam or whatever. Now, they do it as a tradition, as a ritual. That is good. But they are not doing it as a sadhana. So when I am convinced about the glory of the holy name, I will focus on the holy name. And the more I focus on the holy name, the more my attraction to Krishna will awaken. So therefore, it is knowledge of the other processes. If we understand them, then we understand, okay, these processes have so much difficulty, so much complexity. And after that also, the result that I am getting is not complete result. On the other hand, bhakti, it seems so simple, but it's going to give such a great result. So that knowledge will give us the conviction to practice bhakti. So if we have an analytical frame of mind, where the intellectual conviction plays a big role in our doing something, then we can go into the technical analysis of the Bhagavad Gita and understand how Krishna explains bhakti yoga to be the best. But if we are not too intellectually inclined, we are not too much interested in technical analysis, and if we feel inspired to practice bhakti directly, then there is no need to go into technicalities too much. Certainly we should study the philosophy, but the technicalities of the philosophy, we don't have to go into that. So the knowledge helps us to practice the process that increases our devotion. And in that way, you can say knowledge indirectly contributes to devotion. Knowledge doesn't directly contribute to devotion. Any other questions? Okay. In our day-to-day activities, how can we know which is the voice of the mind and which is the voice of the super soul? Yeah. Normally, we are in the modes of passion and ignorance. Even when we are practicing sadhana bhakti, say in the morning program when we try to wake up early, do our sadhana, that time we are trying to cultivate the mode of goodness. And that is very good, it is very essential. At the same time, in the rest of the day, we have to run around, do things, we have so much pressure. So we inevitably will go to the modes of passion and ignorance. Not ignorance, at least passion we will go into. So generally, when we are in the mode of passion or ignorance, our inner vision becomes very blurred. So when we are running around and doing things, at that time we get some impulses. Maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. We should know that that is actually usually not the voice of the super soul. So when we are ourselves busily running around doing things, we get an impulse, let me do this, let me do that. we can assume that it is the voice of the mind. When we have cultivated the mode of goodness, when we are ourselves thoughtful and introspective, and then we observe, okay, we get some suggestion, we get some idea, we get something, okay, this might be a good idea, it's worth exploring. So what it means is, firstly, we have to see what is the level of our consciousness. Secondly, we have to see whether the idea, whatever is being spoken from the inner voice, whether that is in conformity with Guru Sadhu Shastra or it is all in opposition to Guru Sadhu Shastra. So one time one devotee came to Prabhupada and he said, Prabhupada, you came in my dream yesterday and you told me to take marijuana. You told me to take drugs. So Prabhupada said, that was not me, that was Maya in my garb. So the primary way to discern which is the mind's voice and which is Krishna's voice. Now, Krishna's voice is actually the same as the voice of Guru Sadhu Shastra. So, Achary Chaitya Vakusha Sugatim Vinapti Yo Antar Bahesh Tanudhutam Ashubham Vibhundvani. It is the same one Lord who speaks from inside and from outside. So outside he speaks as the Acharya, he speaks as our spiritual guides, and internally he speaks as the Super Soul. So this means, if the inner voice is telling us to do something that is directly contradicted to Guru Sadhu Shastra, then we should know that this is the voice of the mind, this is not at all the voice of the Super Soul. Now what about when the inner voice is telling us to do something which is directly devotional? That's fine, we can take that up and we can apply that eventually. And what if it is in the grey zone? It is neither anti-devotional nor directly devotional. Sometimes we may get some ideas. See, as I said, Krishna says the mind can be the friend also. And we'll discuss that. Sometimes we get good ideas also. So what we should do is, if some idea comes from within, one of the best ways to evaluate is to press the pause button. Pause means neither yes nor no. I'll wait and I will evaluate. And then when we cultivate the mode of goodness, say when we pray, when we study scripture, when we are in a contemplative, reflective frame of mind, then we can evaluate with greater perspective, more wisdom. And I can say, yeah, this is a good idea. And ultimately, we don't have to go around and saying, you know, I got this idea, it came from the Super Soul. We don't know where it came from. But we have to evaluate the idea on its merit. Yes. Okay, this seems like a good idea, let me implement it at the proper time. So the important thing is, do not just get carried away by the mind. Even if the mind comes up with good ideas, it's not necessary that we have to get carried away by it. So there are impulses and there are some sort of hunches. You know, hunches, usually, the word hunch is usually used to refer to something positive. You know, I had a hunch that this will be right. And sometimes our hunches also work out right. So it's not that we have to be always suspicious of whatever inner voice comes along. We can evaluate, and evaluation requires a calm frame of mind. To the extent we are calm and reflective, to that extent we will be able to evaluate and arrive at a proper understanding. And if there are major decisions to be made, then we shouldn't rest them based on simply our own evaluation. There should also be consultation. So if I have an opportunity, should I take a job here or should I take a job there? Then if suddenly we start feeling, maybe I should take the job here. Sometimes it may happen that, you know, we might get some hunches which are good. Okay, there might be some things positive about this place, something negative about that place. And sometimes our reasoning faculty may not be able to arrive at that conclusion, but just we get that in a sense of inspiration, some insight. So what we should do is, if we get some idea, then rather than just immediately jumping on it, see, either jumping on it or jumping against it, we just say, let me evaluate this. Okay, this, I'm feeling that I should do this. Why should I do this? Try to evaluate, try to analyze. And then if it's a major decision, we should consult. Consult some senior devotees, consult our spiritual guides, and then we make a mature decision. Ultimately, the decision is ours. But we can make impulsive decisions or we can make mature decisions. And mature decisions largely means two things: patience and reflection. Patience means we don't immediately act on whatever is the inner voice saying. And secondly, we reflect. We calmly reflect, and that requires usually doing something which brings us to Satvaguna. Okay. So we will continue this theme tomorrow, and if you have any more questions, we can discuss tomorrow more. Okay, one last question.
Sometimes, normally in subtle body, consider mind influence also. one chitta. So the difference. What is chitta body? The subtle body.
Okay.
Is the chitta a part of the subtle body? This is a little technical. Chitta is actually the embodied consciousness. The Atma is Sat Chit Ananda. That has three categories, characteristics or three integral features of it. One of them is Chit. Chit is consciousness. So, Chit is consciousness, which is an innate faculty of the soul, innate feature of the soul. Chitta is the embodied consciousness of the soul. Suppose a person is going to watch a movie in a theater. Now, in a theater, what happens? Firstly, one light goes off and another light goes on, isn't it? The lights all around go off so that attention goes on the screen and then the lights go on over there. And we see various things over there. Now, the person who is watching a movie, they can actually see who is their neighbor, they can see here, they can see there. But the more they get riveted to watching the movie, then their consciousness goes into that movie and they are not seeing anything else. So, like that, there is the Avaranatmika Shakti and there is the Prakshepatmika Shakti. The Avaranatmika Shakti is that which is like all lights go off. So, we don't see anything else. Prakshepatmika Shakti is throwing. So, the light on the screen goes on and our whole consciousness goes over there. And then we get caught in that consciousness. So, the person who is watching the movie, they can see here and there, but they are absorbed in the movie. And then their whole consciousness, all their emotions and everything is based on whatever they are seeing in the movie. So, like that, the body, the mind and the body, basically the gross and subtle bodies, they are in front of the soul. The soul is different. And the mind, we could say, is like the monitor or the screen on which the movie, on which everything that is there in the world is being displayed. So, the soul's chitta is the original consciousness. It's like the person who can see here and there everywhere. But that is chitta. But when the soul's consciousness gets rooted into the body, into the mind, and through the mind into the body, then that embodied consciousness is called as chitta. So just like the person who is watching the movie, and the person loses awareness of everything else. So chitta is the embodied consciousness. So chitta is the original consciousness. Chitta is when the consciousness is rooted into the body. So Krishna says in the second chapter of the Gita that consciousness comes from the soul. Avinashi tatvini in a sarvavidam tatva. 2.17. But later on in 13.6 and 7, he says that chetana iccha dvesha sukham dukkham sanghata chetana dhruti etat kshetram samasena samikara mudharitam. In 13.7 he states that chetana is a kshetra vikar. Kshetra is the body or field. And vikar is transformation. So he says chetana is a transformation of the body. Now what does it mean? Consciousness is not coming from the body. What is he saying? He says consciousness is a transformation of the body. What that means is the consciousness that we experience right now is based on what is happening in the body and the stimuli connected with the body. Just like when a person is watching the movie, all their emotions are based on what is happening in the movie. So like that, presently our emotions, Ichha, Dvesha, Sukham, Dukkham, all that we experience is connected with the body. And in that sense, so Chit is the original consciousness of the soul. Chit is the consciousness of the soul that is rooted into and is practically trapped in the body. And the mind, intelligence, ego, they are a part of the subtle body. So we could say that they are like the screen and the whole mechanism by which the whatever is being displayed on the screen is being displayed. So, chitta and mana, they are different. Chitta is basically the consciousness being rooted into the subtle body and thereby through the gross body. So, the chitta is not a component of the subtle body. Rather, chitta is what is being rooted through the subtle body. Chitta is the energy of consciousness that is being rooted through the subtle body. Does that answer your question? Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Shrimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Gaur Premanande ki,
Jai
Prabhupada ki, Jai.